In the 2 weeks that I'm with you, we are looking at the Gospel of John, and I've titled the 2 weeks Journeys of Faith, Reading Our Way into the Fourth Gospel. And my name is Jeff Staley. I teach at the University of Portland in Portland, Oregon. And today the title is Deciphering the Signs, John 2, 1 through 25. We've looked at the prologue and talked about beginnings of Gospels and beginnings of our own journeys of faith. Where, if anywhere, can we point to a beginning? And then yesterday we looked at the call of the first disciples, and particularly the witness of John, and asked questions about mentors or pathfinders along our own journeys of faith, who our mentors have been, if we have been mentors, and what the values and the problems related to that. And today we're looking at the first two miracle story, actually, in the gospel, the wedding at Cana, which is followed by something else which I think is also a sign, and that is the cleansing of the temple. Now this is one of those peculiar things in John, peculiarities about John. The cleansing of the temple comes right early in the gospel, whereas in the synoptics you have it at the end. And these two events, the wedding at Cana, a miracle story, juxtaposed to the cleansing of the temple, give us, I think, some idea of what a sign is. And I see as this you will have to decipher as well. Deciphering is what that's supposed to say up there. Deciphering the sign. And as I've said earlier too, the metaphor I'm using for this is our faith, our life as Christians, our development into that image of God, which is the theme for this summer, as a journey. Life is a journey, and talk about the various aspects of that along the way. Miracle stories and fairy tales. Snow White, Hansel and Gretel, Ronald Reagan's America, the ultra-bright toothpaste smile, General Norman Schwarzkopf's Little War. We love the simple plots. Lost in the dark forest, separated from family, the youths find love and happiness. America kicks butt and exercises the demons of Vietnam in a 40-day test in the desert. We're still number one. There's a prince in the forest, an oven for the witch. The stories are so transparent. They're so clear, so obvious, so easy, so unlike real life. I have a problem. A hero figure appears. The hero solves the problem. The world cheers. We all want a miracle story that will make sense out of our journey. A white knight on a silvery steed laying down his cloak over each muddied rivulet. A daring rescue, a chance discovery, to be found in the panic of lostness. So too, in the fourth gospel, the disciples move quickly from call to bold confession of faith to miracle. From birth, that is the call, to wedding, chapter 2. It's a fairy tale beginning. Well, today, these first two powerful acts of Jesus, the wedding at Cana, the cleansing of the temple, the first is a classic miracle story, and we'll spend some time talking about what a miracle story is and what that structure is. And the second is more like a heroic deed. The second cleansing of the temple is not a miracle by any means, but it certainly gives one an idea of what kind of character Jesus is going to be. It's more like perhaps a test of Achilles or Odysseus or whatever. It's something that gives us a clue as to who Jesus will be. Zeal for my house shall consume me. Whatever that means is the statement that is made about the cleansing of the temple. Both of these, the author in some sense gives us the idea that we're talking about a sign. The Gospel of John never uses the word miracle, or in the Greek, the word miracle, dunamis, a powerful act, an act of power, but uses a different word, a Greek word, semeia, for these deeds that normally we would call miracles. And that begs the question, you know, what does the author mean by this term, sign or signs? Both of these are somehow signs along the path of faith, leading to something, leading to somewhere. But the question, of course, is to what do these signs point along the way? The typical miracle story form, and we can talk about it in four steps, and most begin with a problem. What's the problem? Well, the woman gets on the bus, and as she gets on the bus, the cameras focus on her scratching her hair. She's got a problem. She notices at the back of the bus a young man, handsome man. And she smiles at him. He looks up. He's about to smile when suddenly he sees she's doing what? She's scratching her hair. We have a problem. What's the problem?
Dandruff.
And it's not just any problem, right? I mean, by the whole scenario, there's something more at stake than simply dandruff, right? I mean, this is man, woman. There's something going on here, possibly going on here. The start of something big, right? Except for the fact that she's scratching her hair. So she's got a problem. The problem is dandruff. But really, underneath that, I think I spelled it right, there's a more basic problem. We'll talk a little bit about what that might be. Enter what? The problem solver. Whenever you have a problem, you've got to have a problem solver, right?
Right.
What's the problem solver?
Head and shoulders.
Head and shoulders. I think it's head and shoulders, and that's one of these I can spell. Head and shoulders. Could be a number of other things too, I suspect, but I think in this case it's head and shoulders. So enter head and shoulders, and you get a big close-up of the product at that point. And we see her probably in the next scene, she's in the shower and she's scrubbing her hair. Sometimes, depending on the commercial, of course, it may be you divide the head in half, right? In half there you get one kind of shampoo and the other half another. I think this is Tegrin. Which is one. I love this commercial because the Tegrin side does what? How do you know it's working?
Tingles.
It tingles, right? What is there about tingles that means that it's shampoo? It could be anything in there. You know, they could put an extra dose of alcohol or sand or whatever. Who knows? But somehow there's something in there. Or you take another scenario. You know, we could take a problem of a crucial problem of bad breath. Again, it destroys relationships, right? Bad breath destroys relationships like dandruff can thwart relationships.
Grounds for divorce.
Grounds for divorce, right. But enter something like certs, right? And certs has magic to it, too. Certs has a ding. A little drop of what?
Retsin.
What is retsin, brothers and sisters? Who knows? Well, I had a marketing student in my class last semester. We were talking about miracle stories. Told me, and I think this. I'd like to be able to prove this true, and I don't know where to find it. But told me that retsin is actually vegetable oil. and this person seemed to know what she was talking about. But give the thing a wild sounding name, right? Someone said this morning a toothpaste with hexachlorophene or something like that. I don't know, what's hexachlorophene? But there are in miracle stories, of course, something utterly different. Talitha Kumi, wow. That mean? Got no Aramaic, it just means little girl, get up. But they translate that for you. But wow, what a wild sounding word, strange expression. So you need a problem solver, head and shoulders, and if you can think of a name for some magical formula It sounds scientific to put in there, put it in there. And then, of course, we have, if we have the, we have the problem solved, of course.
They ride off in the sunset.
They ride off in the sunset. Well, yeah, close to that. And she, this time she gets back on the bus the next day, right? And she's not scratching her hair. The same guy is sitting back there. And she smiles at him, he smiles at her. And she sits down next to him, says hi, and he says hi back.
And they don't have dandruff on their shoulders.
Right, right. And that's the beginning of a beautiful relationship. And then, of course, that's, in a sense, the problem solved. Actually, I think we actually that's really more the proof of, or the evidence of the problem solved. Problem solved, I think we see right before she shakes her head, you know, after she gets out of the shower and dries up. And you see that her hair is beautiful and shiny. And of course, you can interchange. It could be a man too. I think sometimes it's a man, depending on whether it's a football game, I suppose, or some other kind of show. You know, you reverse the
commercials are better than
What?
The commercials are better than a lot of the shows.
That's true. And sometimes that's true. That's why we have Clio Awards, right?
Yeah.
But you know, you the miracle story form is not. It's not new. It's not invented by Madison Avenue, but it's thousands of years old in terms of the structure of stories. And it's important to notice at this point, we're not saying anything about the historicity of events. That is, it may be, in fact, that Head and Shoulders really does work, okay? Or Tide, whatever it is, whatever the problem, you know, whatever the problem solver is. These things may actually work. We're not making a statement as to whether these things work or whether about historical evidence or anything behind that, but simply to say that miracle story has a certain structure to it, and you can tell it in a very simple form, and it's, this form has been around for thousands of years. One can learn some really interesting things about our culture. And I was thinking particularly about Bob Stiver's talk last night. If you look at this particular miracle story, here's the form, and then put off here, give me a classic miracle story. Well, I'll give you one. Feeding of the 5,000, okay? From the Gospels. Problem. What's the problem? Too many people and no McDonald's. So the problem solver, it's not going to be McDonald's, right? It's, but it's going to be, it's not going to be Burger King. But in this place, in place of Head and Shoulders is something we have what? The problem solver is going to be a person, is going to be Jesus. We see the problem solved, the breaking of the loaves, and the and then of course the proof they have, whatever, 12 baskets left over. Now, if you compare these, the ancient Christian miracle story to the modern miracle story, there's some interesting differences. I mean, you look at our miracle stories, the problem solver is what compared to who?
It's a product.
It's a product, right. And usually a product, and you think of the names we give our products, some kind of technological wonder, right? What is it that is going to solve our problem? It's going to be some kind of technological innovation. You know, and oftentimes we put something new in it that we can't explain. The little blue things in Tide, who knows what those are, you know, what the, whether they're anything different than Tide. Now, I think, isn't it Tide with now with the little blue crystals or something like that, or you know, you add Tegrin, you had Tegrin 1, now you have Tegrin 2 with something else in it, who knows what it is. The problems really haven't changed that much. You look at the miracle stories of Jesus, other than, now, sometimes they deal with problems of food and things, but most of them deal with problems really of cleanliness. The leper, what's the problem with the leper? It's a problem of cleanliness. And cleanliness in ancient Hebrew society, like our society tells us, problems of cleanliness separate people, destroy relationships, right? A leper is taken outside the city, has to live somewhere else. The woman with the hemorrhage in the story stuck in the middle of Jairus' daughter, the healing of Jairus' raising of Jairus' daughter, she has a a blood disorder, that a hemorrhage that separates her from the community. This is a problem of cleanliness. Miracle after miracle in the Gospels deal with problems of cleanliness. Cleanliness problems that separate one from the rest of society, destroy relationships. Well, you know, many of our commercials deal with problems of cleanliness too. The difference is, of course, we think we're going to solve the miracle for us. The miracle worker is technology of some kind. And here, the ones we really don't believe, you know, the type of miracle stories we don't believe are those where we see a human being, a person, a miracle worker, Jesus, whatever, as a problem solver. Problem solved, whatever, you know, this restored relationship, person brought back into the community, they're clean, and everything's fine and dandy. Well, if you know the miracle story form, problem, problem solver, problem solved, and proof, it can give us, I think, a lot of insight into the miracle stories in the New Testament. Because one of the things that I love the most about the Gospel of John is that this author seems to know the form, the structure of the miracle story, and then does all kinds of fun things with it. I suppose it's if you know music really well, which I don't, but and know a certain kind, a certain style of music, a certain type. I don't know, you know, pick a fugue or something like that. I don't even know what a fugue is, but I think I can spell it. If you know what, you know, types of music Bach dealt with, and the typical structure of that piece of music, and then what Bach does to make variations on it, it becomes much more interesting and exciting. Wow, you know, what a genius, what a creative person this was to take this very strict structure of a piece of music or a poem or whatever, and yet look what this person does with that and how they adapt that. Same way here in the fourth gospel. I think John, this author, knows this form well, but then does some very strange things with that form. And the first and a wonderful example of it is the wedding at Cana. What I'd like you to do for a few minutes is to read through the miracle, chapter 2, verse 1 through 11. And the easy part is this. What's the problem? Problem solver, problem solved, and the proof. And then ask a few questions about that. Which I think get at the variations. So what's the problem solver, the problem, the solution, and the evidence of that? The questions related to that, when does the miracle occur? When does the miracle occur? Who knows or sees the miracle take place? And thirdly, who believes as a result of it? So three questions. I think that's three. When does the miracle occur? Who knows or sees the miracle take place? And thirdly, who believes? Well, you got some ideas here? Problem. No, mine. It's not a problem if you're Baptist, but anyway. Right. For the wedding, the problem is no wine. That doesn't sound like a very drastic problem compared to some people's problems. And but anyway, in this particular context, this is the first miracle story, and this is the problem. The problem solver, Jesus. And we haven't seen any miracles in the gospel yet. But it's interesting how Jesus is pointed out. It's by the mother of Jesus who comes to him, which is rather unusual because it's not, so far as we know, Jesus is not the one getting married. I mean, it would seem logical that the mother of Jesus would be concerned if it's her own son's wedding. But she, perhaps it's a relative, we don't know, or perhaps she knows something about Jesus that nobody else knows. Anyway, it's rather curious that it's the mother of Jesus who comes to him and says, look, they have no wine.
Jeff, quickly note then also add the name of Mary to that, because she is, Jesus is wearing his three human channels, as he does in the feeding of 5,000, the little boy with his loaves, and uses our hands and our, whoever we are. Should not Mary be involved in the problem solver here? She brings the problem to him.
Uh-huh.
He knew, well, you know, all the things. When we look at Jesus, well, they knew everything anyway.
Yeah.
Or he did not, but I think Mary should, in my feeling, should be in there.
Should be in there as part of the problem solver.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's an interesting.
She's a problem identifier.
A problem identifier, yeah. She is, in a sense, she's the one that raises this issue to Jesus. Of course, you have the wonderful, this is a very peculiar statement of Jesus. It says, what is this to you and me? My hour hasn't come, as though, and it's more interesting in Greek, because in Greek, it's, in English, we put my hour has not yet come, as though, wow, the hour is something really significant. And everyone, all commentaries then talk about what is the hour of Jesus? What is his hour? In Greek, actually, it's just the opposite. It goes, the hour, or not yet, let's see, not yet has come the hour, and the last word is my. So if you read it, the my is, and the hour is not emphatic at all. You read it in English, you read the first thing, my hour has not yet come, as though that's the whole emphasis of the sentence and the issue to be talked about. But in Greek, the hour is really not seemed to be that crucial. It could be the hour of anything. You know, is he going to have, is he the juggler at the wedding? Who knows? My hour has not yet come. The hour, we don't know what his activity is. It sounds, the my in there is very strange. The hour hasn't yet come for what? For the final drinking or something like this, when everyone's really going to get drunk. The hour hasn't yet come, and then he puts the little word my in there. What's this wedding have to do with Jesus? We see in the same way in the next story where he talks about the house, but then he puts the house of my father. Again, the little word my in there is very peculiar. It makes you kind of ask questions. Who is this? What is this little my in here that makes Jesus, wherever he is, all of a sudden these events take on different, more personal significance. But anyway, we could talk about then the problem solver and put in parentheses Mary and the mother of Jesus. Solution. And here we could be a pun too, right? We're talking about real liquids here. Same way here, right? The solution is what?
Changing the water.
Okay, right. We get no wine and now we get wine. Lots of it. Proof.
Steward.
About 17%, right? No.
The steward.
Testified. Right.
And the servants.
The stewards tasted, and that's important. So this story seems to have a pretty, it has your basic miracle story structure to it. We have no line, we have a problem solver, we have a solution, and then we have evidence of that. The wine, an interesting thing here too, is that these are waters for purification of the Jewish people. Huge, huge jars, each six of them, each carrying, holding how many? 20 to 30 gallons, something like that. Because if you work in the kitchen, work in a hospital, you got to wash a certain way, right? Let the water run off your fingertips, the same way among Muslim cleansings. So you got to have a lot of water. Well, he filled up six jars, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. You've got a lot of wine on your hands or in your cups, whatever. 130 gallons of wine. It's a lot of wine. Oh, it's a mouse. I thought maybe it was. Oh, I shouldn't say.
We thought you were maybe all testing the wine back there.
Yeah, it's a chip. We'll pretend it's a chip. it's probably just a nice, cute little field mouse.
Why was the wedding held in this particular town?
We don't know. There's all kinds of suggestions that have been made. Perhaps it's the town that of Nathaniel. Perhaps someone.
We were there. Why the city is in the end of the little valley.
Uh-huh.
But there is no wine grown in that area because no sunlight and poor soil, so all the wine has to be
brought in.
Yeah. So do you think somewhere back in somebody's mind that this miracle had to take place in a place where it could take place?
Huh, I don't know.
Because they can't grow wine in this town, and that's the town that the wedding was held in. So.
Interesting.
Maybe you could have 2,000
years ago. Yeah.
Well, on this proof thing, I think we're missing a real important thing. The steward didn't know where the wine came from.
Hold on a second. These are these questions we're getting to. That's the question. When does the miracle occur? That's the other part of the question. When does the miracle occur?
Third year.
Not what day, but...
When the water was changed.
Okay, and when was the water changed?
Someplace between the pouring and the steward's tasting.
Yes, yeah, somewhere between the servant's pouring and the steward's tasting. Precisely where, though?
Well, when they followed the orders of Mary, she says, "Do what he tells you."
Do what he tells you. There really is a way. It's pretty ambiguous, really. In there, it takes faith. Take the miracle story of the raising of Jairus' daughter. When does the miracle occur? You know that one. 12-year-old girl.
When Jesus says,
Right, it takes her by the hand. No problem, you know. I mean, you have a picture of the miracle. When does the miracle occur in the feeding of the 5,000?
When
he blesses it and distributes it. What about when Jesus heals a blind man?
Spit
in his eye and the eyes are open. You know, it's very obvious in... like every other miracle story in the gospel, it's very obvious when the miracle occurs. Now here's the very first, quote, sign, unquote, or miracle in this story. And you ask the question, you know, when does the miracle occur? And you really can't tell when the miracle occurs.
Maybe Jesus didn't know how to do it yet.
That could be. Okay, that's a good idea. Yeah, he'll get better at this. Right, hasn't quite figured it out yet. That's a good point.
The thought occurs to me, if Mary had not offered Jesus as the solver of the problem, would he have offered to solve the problem?
Well, good question. I mean, it is true in this gospel, most...
Yeah, so I think he was aware of it, that it would happen, but that it wasn't just yet.
In my translation, it says, "You must not tell me what to do," when she says they are out of wine. So it's as if he already knows that she doesn't need to tell him.
Uh-huh. We certainly know from the chapter before that Jesus seems to have a knowledge beyond normal human abilities, where he says to Nathanael, you know, "Before Philip called you, I saw you under the fig tree." Knowledge of events and things. Of course, you go back to the prologue. I mean, geez, you know, the beginning. In the beginning was the Word. There's this kind of other aspect of Jesus. So I think, the reader even at this point would have an idea that we don't really Jesus can do something without the human agent. But quite often in here, the human agency is very important. The second part of this, so we don't know exactly when the miracle happened. What about who knows or sees the miracle take place?
How can anyone see the miracle take place?
Mm-mm. Why do you say that?
Well, because the servants poured the water in, and then they drew some out, and they took it to the steward. And, I mean, the servants knew where the water had come from.
Okay, yeah, that's
but
right.
But they didn't say, "Wow, look, this water is now wine."
Okay.
I mean, so it must have looked, white wine. It must not have
looked no bubbles,
any different when they threw it out.
Well, this version says, when the steward of the feast tasted the water now become wine and did not know where it came from.
Okay.
Though the servants who had drawn the water knew.
Knew what? They knew where the water came from,
they
right?
Knew.
Yeah, they knew that because they had filled it up.
If the steward said it was wine, then the servant knew that the water they had poured had become wine.
Right. They don't know exactly when or anything.
No, but they
right?
knew it had happened.
Right, yeah. But they don't, so far as we know, they don't say anything. Or that you don't say it this time, nudge the steward, say, hey, you know, we know what happened here.
Well, typical stewards, when they got back in the kitchen, they'd be snickering at the dumb, I mean, typical servant, they'd be snickering at the dumb steward. He didn't know where it came from.
I think you're exactly right. I think this is there's a joke here in
That's
this story.
What I feel. It's
yeah.
The parentheses is a joke.
I think
it's
you're right.
It's kind of like
yeah.
Jesus showing, that the birth took place in a stable, and who first learned about it, you know, was the shepherds out in the field, the lowliest people, and so the servants here, being the lowliest people, have the first little glimpse into this almighty thing that happened.
Okay. The next thing is, let's see, no one knows or sees the miracle take place, but right, the servants have an idea that something strange has gone on here. Who is it that believes?
The disciples.
Now that's curious because the disciples haven't been mentioned since the first verse when they came to the wedding, and they haven't been anywhere in the story. You have, and yet all of a sudden they're the ones who believe. Where have they been? You know, are they sitting in the background, or why not the servants believing? Why not the chief steward or something, or
does
Mary believing?
John, Mary, Jesus' disciples are going for.
What
does John mean? Jesus' disciples then, or the people in John's church when he wrote this?
I suspect this is the same disciples who had followed him.
Could well have double meanings in the church.
Yeah, that's true. It could. And in a sense, I think there may be something in what you say, because I think, in a sense, the only person who sees the whole thing from beginning to end is the reader.
Because there's a conflict in John between, as I recall, between Jewish and Christian. It's about the split.
Right,
and
yeah.
So the disciples would know, but then that would say that the other people didn't know.
The other people didn't know, yeah. And you get the very beginnings of this division between the different, the quote, the Jews in this gospel. You have a very, everyone in the book is a Jew except Pilate, but of course you have the Jews who are portrayed as the antagonist all the way through, and anybody in leadership generally is put in that category. And perhaps you have the very beginnings of this kind of confrontation. The thing, what about the chief steward? The only evidence that you have that a miracle has taken place comes from whom? Who is the only one that can give any evidence in who gives any evidence in the story that a miracle, that something weird has gone on?
The steward,
who is in fact that, who knows what?
He's got wine.
Well, he knows he has wine, but he doesn't know what,
where
it came from. So I mean, the other joke, I mean, it's a joke on the steward, like you said. I mean, the only person who knows what that a miracle is, the only way we've discovered that a miracle has taken place is through somebody who doesn't know that a miracle has taken place.
So there's a kind of play on the knowers and the not knowers.
Yeah, the knowers and the not knowers. Well, there's one other miracle in this Gospel of John like this, and as far as I know, no others in any of the Gospels where that you discover a miracle that has taken place through somebody who doesn't know that a miracle has taken place. I mean, normally you have evident, people standing out there that say, wow, look what's happened. You know, we're seeing this with our own eyes. We see Jesus touch this person or anoint their eyes or whatever, or break the loaves. And everybody around knows that a miracle has taken place. But here the evidence comes from a simple taste from a person who doesn't know that a miracle has taken place. Yeah.
Well, the thing that impresses me about this miracle is that they said who believes is the disciples. But Mary, the mother, knew the miracle could occur,
uh-huh,
and forecast that it would occur.
Uh-huh.
When she, in fact, ordered her son to change the water to wine.
Or so said, do something, yeah.
Yeah. She had the faith, or she knew that the miracle was going to occur, yet it's not mentioned that she knew it occurred.
Yeah, if you look at this miracle story, the way the characters are put together, normally in a miracle, in a typical miracle story, you have a continuity of character all the way through. You know, you have the person who has the problem, obviously, is the person who's healed, and is the person who in some way gives testimony, evidence of that. You have some continuity all the way through the story. Even Jesus is not continuously evidenced in this story. He's at the beginning, and then he disappears. He's nowhere else. The servants fill it, bring it to the chief steward, and they disappear. The disciples are there at the very beginning. They come up at the end. They believe. Where are they in the middle of the story?
Well, everybody goes to these weddings, and if they've been following Jesus, just like in most places, you kind of hang around together. Mm-hmm. And so they probably were there when they asked him to fill the thing with water, you know, so they saw it, and then they believed.
Well, but yeah, the thing is, that may be true. The interesting thing is that the author doesn't say that.
No.
And I think that's what's fun. Actually, what makes the story fun is the way in which the story is told. The only person, you know, you don't know what the disciples have seen. Mm-hmm. We're not told. The only thing is that we have been told quite a bit as readers. In a sense, we kind of, I think, are like the disciples here, and it's to bring us to believe.
But if you're following somebody, you usually hang around together.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so I assume that they saw, and they probably were kind of wondering themselves if they were going to be drinking water and what was going to happen. You know, then this happened.
Yeah. I like that point that I think it was that Carol made, that this is a very, when you know the miracle story form and know how unambiguous and how obvious most miracle stories are, this is a very strange way to begin. And for the author to say at the end, this, the first of Jesus' signs he did in Galilee or something like that, and his disciples believed him, you look at it, I think there's all kinds of ambiguities in this miracle story that make you scratch your head and think, you know, what is really going on here? I mean, if you want to pick a nice miracle story, you know, the author could have done much better than this. It looks great at the beginning, but when you actually get down and read it carefully, there's some very strange things going on.
Well, you really have to wonder, since this manifested
his glory. What does
that
mean?
What do you mean? Most people didn't even know what happened.
I know, exactly, yeah. And this manifested his glory? Huh?
Isn't that sort of an indication that miracles are always ambiguous? Ooh. That is, they can create faith, but they may just as likely not do that.
Ooh, okay. And
I have one question with this.
Good. Hold on to that, because you're it's perfect lead into my question. Yeah.
It says, when was the water turned into wine? And they fill these jugs or these containers with, what did you say, 130 gallons or something like that. Was that all turned into wine, or did the miracle occur when the steward opened the tap and it run into the pitcher?
Good question. And every commentary, I mean, it's actually quite fun to read commentaries at this point, because they all want to make it more specific. They want to answer those kinds of questions. And what does the miracle mean? What does it mean to manifest his glory? What about this question to Mary? That Mary asks, what's the role of the mother of Jesus? What does Jesus say by, you know, not yet, the hour has come, my hour, kind of as a parenthesis? What do these things mean? But I don't think there's enough clues in the story to really tell us all that. I think it's not until you read on in the gospel that you can kind of perhaps go back to this story and say, oh, aha, I think I can see some other things in it.
If they put all those things in, the story would be so long that nobody would ever read it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ambiguities here that I have. I think it's purposely that way, to raise a lot of questions that perhaps may be answered in the page.
Story didn't think of all these things.
Yeah, right. I think as you read these miracle stories, this author knows enough about them. Plays enough games with them that this is—it's no accident.
Do you suppose the author put this story of Jesus at a wedding, did he put that in there, do you suppose, so that, what I'm trying to say is, was the superiority or in the thinking of celibacy started by this time, so that John thought that maybe he ought to put in something about Jesus blessing or being present at a wedding?
I don't believe so, but certainly within, you know, the next century.
I just wondered if it started there, because we use it now in the church at weddings frequently.
Yeah.
I thought, well, maybe already this tendency towards the celibacy being superior had already started. And he put this in there for a point.
Well, we'll come to another fun story, the issue of celibacy with the Samaritan woman, which I think is another
point. I haven't heard yet. That's the whole issue of obedience, and it's just a miracle about changing water into wine, or is it a miracle about responding to what our Lord tells us to do?
Good question. Responding in the sense that Mary says, or the mother of Jesus says, this, Jesus responds. She says, do whatever
he tells you to do.
And his servants.
And they do it.
Yeah.
And is that the real miracle? It's like when we deal with problems today, and we, for example, say, let's pray about it. Uh-huh. That is, for me, a first step.
Uh-huh.
And then but people say, what good is prayer? All this, you know, we need to do this, this, and this, and whatever. And yet to be centered and focused in prayer, for me, is a first step. That's, to me, in obedience for our Lord, it seems impractical. It doesn't apparently do anything, but it prepares us for the work to be done. And I've never done it as one example.
That's a possibility.
The Lord.
Yeah. I think all these... those are some of those avenues that are possible that I don't think one can clearly answer from this particular story. And as you get more stories, I think you may begin to answer them. I mean, write these up here for us to talk about in our groups of three again. For you, if any,
right?
What? I get my sentence right here. Speaking of deciphering, you may have to decipher my writing here. Okay, the first question, and you can begin to find a group of three. For you, what, if any, have been the signs along the way of God's presence in your own particular journey of faith? Second question, are signs a necessary part of our journey of faith? And then the third question will be, to an outsider, would these signs appear ambiguous or unambiguous? That is, would they be obvious or not obvious as signs to an outsider? So we don't have much time, so let's break up into groups and begin talking about it. For you, what, if any, have been the signs along the way of God's presence? If John's Gospel begins with this wonderful sign, what do we have?
The consensus of our discussion was that he provides before we know it.
That God provides before we know it. And one thing I didn't say in this that you get at the completion of the heroic deed, the cleansing of the temple, is that nobody understands what Jesus is doing in the temple until the narrator says the disciples didn't understand until... when? Two things. Until after he was raised from the dead, until after Easter, and until they understood Scripture. So in a sense, quite clearly in this, there's all, I think you're right, there is a sense of the knowledge, the understanding doesn't come till after, after the fact, and after something has given you a different perspective on it. And perhaps that may be true. It doesn't help you through the experience then, does it? I mean, gee.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it does?
Oh, it does. Your faith that it will be provided.
Okay, so if you've had some of these experiences and seen afterwards, wow, this is...
like the poem, The Footprints. Mm. There was another set of footprints mm-hmm. carrying you along the way.
Okay. Anybody else in terms of signs along the way?
I live in a community that has been kind of brought together as a family. God's presence now in the center of our community.
And so you see that would be one of those signs.
I can see it as a sign. Outsiders have just seen the difference.
Okay, okay. What about the second one? Are signs a necessary part of our journey of faith?
Yes.
You say yes. Why? Any?
Too easy not to believe.
It's too easy not to believe. Okay. Other people? At different places in our journeys of faith, that perhaps they're more, they seem more prevalent or necessary? Or?
We're experiential people. We know what we experience. And burned into our memory.
Okay.
Senses.
What about the third one? To an outsider, would these signs appear as obvious or not obvious? Think.
Yeah.
You say, which?
I would say no, not to an outsider. Not they would say it's coincidence.
It's so. Coincidence? It's just
I would say how close they were outside.
Okay.
Because if they'd seen it, they would... Really.
Does that create problems for people? That's easy for an outsider. It's
and sometimes to the outsider, they can see a difference in you that you yourself cannot see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they can see things you can't see. So we excuse ourselves, you
uh-huh.
know.
Uh-huh.
I know that one of the a perpetual sign for me is the gift of the Eucharist, and mm-hmm. that I can have every Sunday. And to an outsider, that's very ambiguous. Why okay. is that a sign of God's presence in anything at all?
Okay. 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 Good.
Well, the Final. Outsider may not always just be maybe the unbeliever. If that's what we're
right,
talking
yeah.
about here.
I'm right. Not necessarily.
Thinking about a little event that took place with my daughter. And I was telling my husband about it, and he just couldn't believe that as being any kind of a miracle at all, because it involved the car.
Oh.
Starting or not starting, and yeah. that thing's mechanical.
Okay. Well, good. I think that this has sparked some good conversation, and I hope that we will look at a few other miracle stories in John. That if nothing else, you'll never look at the miracle stories in John, or miracle stories in general, quite the same way. You know, if you know the form, the structure, ask the questions, how does this deviate from that? I think it can give you a lot of insight into an author's use of them. And sometimes I think they suddenly become, which I think they were intended, very funny, very humorous, and very thought-provoking in a different way. And we'll see you tomorrow, I hope.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.